Hello, this is Katerina. It is 6 minutes after 2 p.m. and you're listening to WRFL 88.1 FM Lexington. You're listening to Accents, a radio show for literature, art and culture. I'm your host and producer. My name is Katerina Stoikova-Klemmer. We will start with submissions from our listeners for the weekly writing prompts. The prompt for last week was contact. I'm sorry to say that we did not choose to read any of the submissions that we received for you today. And instead, I'll just assign the writing prompt for next week's show. The writing prompt will be play. P-L-A-Y. Write about play and send your work to me at katerina.klemmer@gmail.com, katerina.klemmer. The next show will begin by reading a few of those submissions. Listeners living in the Lexington area or those otherwise willing to travel to the studio may be invited to read their own work on the air. You are listening to Accents, a radio show for literature, art and culture. I am your host and producer, Katerina Stoikova-Klemmer, and my guest today is poet Erin Keane. Hi, Erin, how are you doing?
Hello, great, how are you?
I'm doing really well. Thank you so much for traveling from Louisville today.
Oh, well, thank you very much for having me.
Let me tell you a few words about Erin Keane. She lives, works and writes in Louisville, Kentucky. She is the author of two collections of poetry, Death Defying Acts, which just came out from Word Farm, and the Gravity soundtrack, Word Farm 2007. She is the theater critic for the Courier Journal in Louisville, Kentucky, and covers books and pop culture for Velocity. Her poems, essays, and reviews have appeared in many magazines and anthologies, including Minnetonka Review, The Lumberyard, Motif, New Southerner, Now and Then, and Louisville Magazine. A recipient of fellowship from the Kimmel Harding Nelson Center for the Arts and the Al Smith Fellowship from the Kentucky Arts Council, she directs the Inky Reading Series in Louisville, Kentucky. Keane also serves on the editorial boards of New Southerner and the Heartland Review. Erin lives upstairs in a creaky old Victorian house in Louisville, Kentucky, with her partner Drew and her cat, Harold Bloom. She be happy to show you around. That's what I've heard.
It's true, I would.
So now I'm holding in my hand your new book titled Death Defying Acts. And I think it's a fascinating book of persona poems. Please tell us about the premise of the book.
Well, the book is, it's sort of a, I guess I started calling it a novel in poems, which Nicole Brown, another Kentucky poet, also has hers out, Sister, and we were in a writing group together and started talking about this concept. We worked on the books together at the same time, so that was really exciting. But if I'm honest with myself, it's probably more of a novella in poems, a povella. Mm-hmm. I just heard that portmanteau. But there is a narrative structure to it. It tells the story of these, mainly in the four different stories of these circus performers. There's an aerialist, a tattooed lady, a lion tamer, and a clown. And then there are some other voices that come in and out. And basically what happens is there's this small traveling circus. It's both contemporary and not. It's not, kind of moves in and out of time. It doesn't have a very fixed timeline on it. But the clown joins the circus and events are set in motion. Things happen because it's a story. But what I was interested in exploring were, I wrote a tattooed lady poem. Mm-hmm. And
so that was the first one?
Yes, yes. And then what happened was, and I started thinking about what about a character who, because I worked a lot in persona in my first book also, and that's a poetic mode that I'm really comfortable working in. And so I thought, well, what about a series of poems about this tattooed lady? Because what I realized was that I felt like I was writing the same poem over and over again. And rather than seeing that as a problem, I decided to see that as an opportunity or as a sign somehow that there was material here to explore. So, but then once I started really writing a series of tattooed lady poems, what happened was other voices started to kind of appear and want to talk and want to be involved and want to interact with her. And so the project really just grew from there.
Tell us about the structure of the book. How did you group the poems into different sections, and what is the purpose of putting an opening poem in front?
Well, the opening poem serves as the prologue. You know, I think back to the Canterbury Tales, you know, is kind of, to me, one of the, of course, I mean, I think to everyone in the English literature, it's one of the, it's the formative version of this form, this genre. And so the prologue really sets up the story, or at least the tone and the setting for the audience. So I wanted the reader to be able to open the book and get an idea of what they were going to be reading about, which is this small circus. And this circus where the performers, the story that concerns these performers has very little to do with you, the audience. This is really their story. But the prologue is an invitational prologue. It's inviting folks in to see a side of these performers' lives that is not the side that you see when you're sitting in the audience watching.
Could we please hear that poem?
Sure. The Corsican Brothers Circus presents death-defying acts. In Montserrat County, kudzu adorns telephone wires like stockings in the bath of a black-and-white movie. We slink in around midnight, following the advance man's arrows that point our way to your grounds. It wouldn't matter if you came to spend your week's mad money or stayed home playing euchre and catch. Our crew still blooms a tent out of whiskey grass by daybreak. Midway concessions scream to life. Our miniature small town joining yours for a tight hand of nights in late July when your kids tire of chlorinated days and want nothing more than a game of chance, a sugar tornado, the exquisite horror of a sideshow ticket burning a palm. The Dairy Dell will not compare. And you, jovial farmers, you red-faced salesmen, junior league ladies and bored local belles, you will come to us. You will wind your way up state highway arteries into our pulsing lot. You will clutch your handbags and hard-won prizes, count ice cream stains in the carousel glow. Hand on her knee, you will ascend out of body in a Ferris wheel car, seeing none of our faces from that fleeting height. What will you take from our battered trailers, patchwork tent, three rings thrilled with delight and fear? You have come for one reason, and it is time. Step into our heart and cheer.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Did you have to do any special research to write these poems?
I did some research. I did. I read, I have a kind of an, not an extensive notes section, but I tried to give credit where credit was due, especially to, so I read some books, an autobiography of a lion tamer that a friend of mine in my writing group found at a yard sale was invaluable because it's not an exciting memoir. It's an autobiography. I did this and then I did that and then I did this. It's very dry reading, but what it was really useful for was the lion tamer, actually he worked with a lot of big cats for years in circus shows, talked about the process of training a big cat, which is really just about... large cats have these circles of comfort around them, and they're these kind of orbit bands, invisible. And they have different behavioral reactions depending on which of those comfort zones you're breaching. So most wild animals, their first instinct is to retreat. And so if you move in one way and in a certain distance from a cat, they're going to retreat and move backwards. But then if you move in even closer, then their next instinct is to charge, mm-hmm. to try and get you to back off. So if you know this about a large animal, just by the way that you move around them, and so the things like the whips and the chairs are kind of to get the cats to focus on focal points, but it's all about moving them. Really, it's a giant choreography. So that's what I learned from that. I read some other books about Carnival Strippers by Susan Miselis, the photographer. It's this great photography book about the old carnival circus used to have a stripper tent. And that really informed my character of the lion tamer, because in the book I have, that's how she started out with the circus, was they had one of those girly shows. It's kind of a ragtag operation, like I said. The 1944 Hartford Circus Fire, which was a huge tragedy. Circus tent caught on fire, and thousands of people were injured and died. And a similar tragedy like that, not to spoil something in the book, but a tragedy like that happened to one of the characters before the book began. And so I used that idea as sort of a way to struggle with feelings of being unlucky and feelings of survival guilt as well. The Greatest Show on Earth is a great movie. So much fun to watch if you're thinking about writing about the circus. And I went to see a circus too, Circus Flora in St. Louis, which I went to with Richard Newman, the poet, when I was visiting him there. So, and that was immensely helpful.
So you went there for research and took notes?
I'm sorry?
So you went there for research?
Yes.
And took notes?
Right. Yes. Absolutely. And I was on my way to Nebraska to finish writing the book. I had you mentioned the Kimmel Harding Nelson Center fellowship that I got. I spent 4 weeks there in this tiny town in Nebraska, and it was so helpful for me to be able to really pull the book together.
Please introduce the different characters to our listeners.
Sure. So the characters in the book, we have the aerialist. She is about 15 years old. She's her character is in there because I also was interested in this idea of class structures within a subculture. And so we have the clown, we have the tattooed ladies in the sideshow, we have the lion tamer, and these are performers, but they're the high wire acts are always the big draws in these circuses traditionally. So she's part of a circus royalty family. Her family has been doing this for generations and generations. She's been born into it, she's been bred into it, and it's the only thing that she knows how to do. And her father is going to marry her to another high wire act, and they're going to, you know, continue this dynasty that they've created. And so the book really begins with her questioning that and questioning how she can live a self-determined life. And her name is Talia. There's the tattooed lady. Her name is Miranda. She is, she's covered even on her face in tattoos, and she adds to the art on her body to commemorate how she's feeling, significant acts, even just little whimsical inspirations that attract her. So there's everything about her life is really worn on the outside, on her skin.
How did you name these characters?
That took a long time, actually. And so the titles of the poems are usually announcing who's speaking, like The Tattooed Lady Falls and The Aerialist Pays a Visit or The Lion Tamer's Letter, but I wanted them to have names, and I feel it's really difficult to write fully about a character if you don't know their name. I actually learned that from Silas House, the novelist, who said once that he needed to know three things about a character before he could write them, and it was he needed to know the character's name, he needed to know the character's favorite song, and he needed to know his character's secret. And I thought, well, I at least need to know their names, but I didn't have them at first. I really, I don't know, they just sort of came to me, you know, after a while. But really after I had actually delved deeper into who they were as people. There's a clown. He is unlucky.
Oh, no.
But his unluck is mostly of his own making, as it usually is. His name is Jack. And the lion tamer's name is Celine. And she is a runaway from Louisiana.
Can we hear a few more poems? Maybe one of the Talia's poems?
Sure. One of the aerialist pieces? Sure. Well, I will. This is how the aerialist is introduced. The aerialist grounds herself. And this was the first aerialist poem I wrote, too. They all have a certain form, also, and we can talk about that in
yes,
a bit.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The aerialist grounds herself. Edge of the earth, slippered toes balance, flexing, a platform lip, a spotlight, freeze. Unfrozen, instinct tips reflex, the inching climb backwards, stepping down rung after rung. Ring of mine, your perfect circle has no end, no beginning. Rolling steps in reverse, sawdust swirling. swirl of 10,000 faces, a blur. Shocked murmurs roll over me, out the door, music swelling. Swollen hands begat swollen hands, arms without question. One man's door is another man's window. Windowless, a tent seizes air and holds. There is in and there is out, but only within. All questions catch. Caught in empty space, tumbling weightless within, a window is a door, is a trap, is a trapeze, is a ledge.
Thank you. Thank you, Erin. Beautiful.
Thank you.
So, when did you know you were done? I mean, was it hard to stop writing about these characters?
Well, what happened was it took me about 2 years to write this book, and about halfway through, when I knew what I was writing was not just a sort of linked collection, but a story, about halfway through, I decided how it was going to end. And I knew that I did not have... The last poem took me a long time to write, but I knew what I wanted happening in the poem, and I knew the feeling that I wanted to create with it. And so it was a matter of getting there, really. And I work full time. I direct a reading series. I adjunct, and then I write. And so I have a pretty busy schedule. And getting those 4 weeks away at the artist's retreat was so key. I came there with my book about 2/3 finished, I would say, and unordered also, because it's not a strict narrative per se. There are things where there are flashbacks, you know, we're sort of moving in and out of time, as I said. So what I ended up doing was, I had a writing studio, which was separate from my living quarters, which was fantastic. And I put each poem up on the wall, mm-hmm. and, in with these little clips where I could move them around. And I would just spend time moving from poem to poem and looking at them laid out in that way and deciding, does this poem follow the poem before it, and does it lead up into the poem after it? And where are the holes? You know, where are the narrative gaps here that I'm seeing? Do I need a poem that establishes X, and whose voice will that be? And what will they be doing, and who else will they be talking to?
Did you get feedback from people to discover plot holes and inconsistencies?
You know, by the time that I've finished it, not so much. My editor, Marcy Johnson at Word Farm, works pretty closely with me, and she was, she read it and she said, I think you've got to, like, I can follow the book. So, the editing process with Marcy was really about doing another round of rearranging the poems mm-hmm. again. She's very smart, and she's a great editor. And so she sees things that I don't see, and she saw resonance between poems that needed to be next to each other, that sort of thing. But I worked pretty closely with a writing group that met regularly for a good portion of that time. And so they got to know the characters, but they would get the poems piecemeal, you know.
So we know that you knew when you were done, and you knew how the story ended. Did it happen to you that you wrote a persona poem about any one of these characters after you considered the book finished?
No, I was completely finished with them. I was spent. I gave these four characters and the photo mat booth and the fortune teller and everyone so much time and energy and heart that no, what happened was I just didn't write for a little while. You know, that's kind of how it works for me. I finish a big project and then I don't do anything for long enough that I start beating myself up for not doing anything. And then what I had to do was I started writing poems in my own voice and not letting myself write in persona.
I would like to hear, and I'm sure our listeners would love to hear, one poem about the rest of the characters.
Oh, sure. Well, this was a Nebraska idea that I had when I was up there. I didn't set out to have this these poems or this voice in the book, but I was going to Target because I needed things, and I'm in Nebraska, and Iowa was where the Target was. It was a drive, and in the mall where there was a Target, there was one of those photo booths where you pop in and it takes four pictures of you and spits out the strip, and I started thinking in terms of that sort of iconic long strip of four little printed black and white photos. And I thought, well, what this book is missing is an omniscient eye, an eye that can comment on the action for us. And because so much of what the book is these individual perceptions of what's happening, even when you can see how they don't see the same event the same way, or they don't see each other the same way. So I decided that there was going to be a photo booth on the Midway, you know, the kind of thing you can put some coins in and jump in with your friends. And that was going to be the sort of omniscient eye for us. And so I wrote these poems, and on the page they're arranged. I wish that, they're broken up into two pages, sadly, because of page size. But there are four sections, and each section is roughly the size and shape of one of those little photos from the strip. So this is clown in full makeup and a woman tattooed, a strip of four black and white snapshots from the Midway photo mat booth. 1. Dark bangs frame her face. She barely reaches his nose, at least twice broken. 2 profiles. He's tilted her up to him. His fingers fit the inked outlines on her chin. Lips parted just enough to say, "We are still breathing." 2. Now they are arrows, a two-way street. She's glancing down and past him, lilies exploding her cheek. Eyes lit, he is an ecstatic saint, palms receiving the stigmata, a bit reluctant, his pale face turned up to God. 3. The next frame could be blank, but white heat is its own reward. Flash has backfired, shining too bright a light on our pair. The burn and the dodge, what lingers dark around the edge, like ink or running paint. 4. His hand clutching her hair, exposing a world map on her nape, so bold in the foreground. Black wings feather her shoulders, the back of her head. He's curved in, mouth on her neck, trying to pass for tender.
Thank you. I thought that it is an experience to read the table of contents of this book. Yeah. Masterful choices of titles.
Oh, well, you might be referring to the titles of the clown poems.
Some of them, yeah. Yes.
they're all jokes, and that was, you know, as I said earlier, a lot of the titles of these poems: The Lion Tamer's Act, A Tamed Lion's Dilemma, The Tattooed Ladies First, announce who the speaker is going to be. And so I wanted the clown announcing himself with a joke. Often the joke is about clowns. People hate clowns, is what I've learned. People are afraid of them. They're repulsed by them. And so this is sort of a natural career fit for this guy. And so on top of that, he tells jokes at inappropriate times. Anything time things get too tense or too intense, his fallback reaction is to tell, frankly, a very inappropriate joke.
Well, now, because it's 2:30, we're going to take a very brief music break, and we'll hear from our sponsor. But when we'll come back, we'll hear more poems from the book, and we'll talk about things like which one of these characters was most difficult to inhabit and which most fun. So, something for our listeners to look forward to. You're listening to Accents, a radio show for literature, art, and culture. I'm your host and producer, Katerina Stoikova-Klemmer, and my guest today is poet Erin Keane. We have a few announcements. We're happy to announce the launch of the Asian American Literary Review, issue number one, which features forum responses by David Mura, Ruth Freeman, and others, book reviews by Paul Lai, Timothy Yu. To learn how to subscribe or submit to the magazine, you can visit www.aalrmag.org. Now let's get back to our conversation with Erin. And so far we have been talking about your brand new book, Death Defying Acts. And we talked about the characters that whose stories you're telling. And my question is, which one of these characters was most difficult to inhabit in order to write persona poems? And then I'm going to ask you which was most fun.
So. Well, I think I can answer that in one answer, both of those in one answer. They were both the clown, Jack. He was most difficult because he is not always a pleasant character, and he also doesn't always make very good choices. And to be engineering a character to work against himself and against his, his best interests is a strange feeling for me as a writer. You know, because I love these characters and I want him to be able to triumph, and yet as a character, he is fundamentally unable to get past some of his own stumbling blocks. And when it seems like he is, he sabotages himself. On the other hand, that made him also the most fun character to write about because the style of writing, the line that I used with him was a lot looser. He's a little more disjointed. He tells jokes. That's fun. He has a really wicked sense of humor. And so, a lot of times what I would just try to do is think, okay, well, how could I joke my way out of this situation? Or how could I take something like the idea that everybody says they're afraid of clowns, which I kind of have to question, is everybody out there completely afraid of clowns?
I don't know anybody who's afraid of clowns.
Everybody so. I know says they are. And it just seems like it's become a pop culture meme that it's like sort of trendy to say, ooh, clowns are going to kill me, you know? And so to think about things like that and how a character like Jack would perceive himself being perceived like that and be able to turn it around and say, if you're afraid of clowns, you don't have much in your life to be afraid of.
Well, were there more circus characters that you thought of but didn't include for one reason or another?
I thought about maybe that there would be a sort of a wise, foreman type of guy, one of the crew that could talk also and sort of give the insider's perspective, kind of the old timers, show the new guy the ropes. But I couldn't really tap into his voice. And after a while, I started to feel like that was maybe too much, too much window trappings, and that it was better. His observations were best weaved in other ways, the ones that were useful to the book.
Wow. I noticed that there are about 20 minutes left till the end of the show suddenly. So, please remind our listeners which characters we've heard poems from and which ones we haven't yet.
Well, we've heard an aerialist poem, we heard the prologue, and we heard the photomat booth. If you want, would you like me to read another one or do we not have time?
Well, yes, let's hear another poem from the book and it's your choice.
Okay, well, I will pick... this one is actually, there's only one poem by this character, but it turns out to be a lot of people's favorites. And it's a poem in the voice of the lion who works with the lion tamer. A tamed lion's dilemma. Amusing enough, our games treat for trick what I won't do for a tousled mane, a rump steak cube. My paws press her girly shoulders, horns grunt our leonine waltz, my breath so sharp on her neck. The algebra of appetite, how so much depends on X. My cage, her ring, my tongue lolling. She smells like syrup and smoke. Some kinds of love have you both on your knees, her head inside my mouth agape. This tension hard to beat, the hunger, the snack, they taste the same, a little salty, a bit sweet.
Lovely, thank you. And you mentioned that there is something specific to the form of these persona poems.
There is. Each voice has its own form, largely of my creation. It has a physical shape to it. The Lion Tamer poems are all five-line stanzas, and there are four stanzas in each. And actually, they form a sort of crown throughout, not a sonnet crown, but a crown throughout, where the last line of one Lion Tamer poem will become the first line of another Lion Tamer poem. Which sort of gives shape to that kind of idea of this whole, we're caught in these circles of behavior and these circles of patterns in our life. The Aerialist poems are the most intricate and controlled. They are much like, I think, like her work. They're couplets, seven couplets. And so there's, you know, it's sort of a modified sonnet, but there's a very specific word repetition pattern that happens throughout each of those poems. The Tattooed Lady's poems are just a little blockier, a little longer, solid looking. And then the Clown's poems, as I said, are very fractured. The lines are short, they're choppy, they jump, they're mm-hmm. dropped. There's lots of dashes at the end where he sort of stops and turns and changes his idea. And then there's a fortune teller, and her poems are unrhymed sonnets. And I wanted to do that because with so many different voices in a book, I wanted clues for the reader when you flip through. Once you learn how to read the book, hopefully, you know, hopefully it's easy, it's quick to catch on. You flip the page and you can tell before you even know whose voice you're going to be reading just by the shape of the poem on the page.
That's right. And the name of the book is Death Defying Acts. The author is Erin Keane, and I'm talking to her in the studio right now. And tomorrow you can see her and Martha Greenwald at 4 p.m. in Morris Bookshop. She will be reading, right? You guys are going to be mm-hmm. reading and signing books.
Yes.
Now let's move on to the three rubrics, the three segments, the three questions that I ask all my guests. Literary Term of the Week, Foreign Poet of the Week, and Notable Book of the Week. Erin, have you brought the Literary Term of the Week to teach?
I have brought the Literary Term of the Week. The term of the week is elegy.
Elegy.
An elegy is a poem of lament, a poem of mourning. It's a form, but it's not a fixed form. It's not a metrical or rhyming form. So it's more of a what's considered a shaping form. So it's more about the intent and the purpose of the poem than actual look of it on the page. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the elegy because I think that it still inhabits a place in our contemporary culture, still one that our culture at large will still find a place for an elegy, even if they don't find a place for poetry in general. And I was struck by that when, you know, that English movie, Four Weddings and a Funeral. And at the funeral, one of the characters reads W.H. Auden's Funeral Blues. And Auden isn't a poet that normally makes it into movies, into Hollywood. You know, he's prickly, he's unlikely, he's unlikable, he's a little old-fashioned, but also it's not that sort of empowering, like, you know, stand-up kind of spoken word poetry that would tend to be a little more Hollywood style these days. And so, but I'm struck by that, how many people, like if when you went on the internet, people are still asking on web forums, what is the name of the poem that Gareth or whoever read at that funeral? And, you know, elegies are one way that writers figure out a language for mourning and for loss. And I'm particularly interested in loss, in the poetics of loss in my work. And so I write a lot of elegies. And elegies can be for people, but they can also be for things or for feelings or for times or for places. And
anything that you can mourn.
Anything that you can mourn, right. And I think, you know, in this, we don't always, not everybody has a close-knit community in which they can mourn, and not everyone shares the same types of grief. But an elegy is one way that folks can come together through literature and find that somebody has put voice to the feelings of loss that they have.
Do you have an example?
I do, actually. I have an example from Greg Pape, and who
was joy.
I know, yes. Isn't he great? One of my mentors in graduate school. And
one of mine, too.
That's what I figured. This is actually from the Louisville Review. It's torn out. Katarina can see this. It's a torn out page of the Louisville Review.
We won't tell.
That because I haven't seen this yet in one of his books. It might be in there, but I don't know if it's made it yet. But this is an elegy for the World Trade Center. And it's called, and frankly, the only one that I've read so far that really moved me, honestly. And this is called That Space Inside Them. I'll try to do Greg justice. There is a space up in the air where the 107th floor was, where Rosie and her lover sit waiting at a small table with wine glasses and white napkins folded like flowers. They sip the wine and look into each other's eyes, and it is as if no one else is there. Two glasses of red wine, two of ice water, two eager young bodies dressed for the evening, two pairs of lips saying words they won't remember. Somewhat shy and momentarily at a loss, they hold hands across the table, gaze out the windows at black water rimmed with lights. Two tugs and two barges barely moving, and down below, on her little island, dressed in green lights, Liberty looks small, vulnerable, a charm on a bracelet. Now, and years from now, they will hold that space inside them, their own faces reflected in the glass they look through into lighted distances, and they will hold that image of tender liberty against the other.
Thank you. Beautiful. And Erin, let's move on to Notable Book of the Week. Have you read recently a book that you would like to recommend to the listeners of Accents?
Well, coincidentally, it is Martha Greenwald's new collection. She'll be reading.
I hope she's listening.
Yes, I hope so too. She'll be reading with me tomorrow at the Morris Bookshop. Other Prohibited Items by Martha Greenwald won the Mississippi Review Poetry Series Prize, and it is a fantastic book. Can I read a poem from it?
Yes, you can read a poem of it, yes.
It's a short one. But what I like about this poem, and what I like about many of the poems in Martha's book, is how they incorporate office life, which is a topic that, you know, that I'm up close and personal with, and as are many poetry readers, but it doesn't often make its way into poetry. But Martha finds the poetry even in the cubicle. This is Canceled Drinks with Former Colleague. Because she sat too close beside you at meetings, drafting cartoons rather than minutes, her overfull coffee cup splotching your agendas like a muddy spring storm. Because after sneaking a distant lunch, you watched her sigh and crunch fists of antacids, Clinique Azalea lipstick blurred, an afternoon's birthmark on her cheek. Because candy wrappers rustling under the desk turned into the office autumn when she pushed off to pirouette in that perfect chair. Because her retriever was reborn as a screensaver who fetched and barked all day across the cubicles. Because you'd recognize the syrupy smell of her piss from any adjacent stall. Because you saw her silvered molars when she yawned and found them winking beneath the fluorescence, perhaps a little too lovely.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So, did you have a favorite foreign poet that you would like to share?
I did. This is Xia Yu, and she was born in Taiwan, and she splits her time between Taipei and France, Paris, I believe, where she works as a lyricist and as a translator. I have her, at this point, with her. This was selected poems. She writes in Chinese. This is her selected poems. Fusion Kitsch from 4 previously published books was translated by Steve Bradbury.
So she writes in Chinese, but she lives part of the time in France. Do you think she writes in French also?
She does, actually. There French creeps into her poems. And so in this book, it's fantastic. If I do not read Chinese, but if I did, it's so nice to have on the left side the originals and on the right side the translation by Steve Bradbury. But there are actually, I have a poem marked here, and there are French phrases in it in the English translation.
Could we please hear it?
Sure. This is The Cloistered Queen and Her Invisible City. And I just wanted to say that I really love this poet because I read a lot of ancient Chinese poetry, most of it by men and most of it ancient. And so Greg Pape actually recommended this book to me when I was in school for someone a little more contemporary, still with that Chinese sensibility, but very, very much updated, and also with kind of a French flair as well. And she's a woman and writes beautiful poems. The Cloistered Queen and Her Invisible City. In the kingdom of our cloistered queen, there is a map drawn in many a forced analogy. A kingdom cobbled out of vagrant bronzes, broken promises and testaments, pitfalls that have fallen through, befuddling clues, obliterated fingerprints, and every parasol and pair of glasses ever lost. It is a vast and limitless domain whose imaginary lines she traces in the dark. A veritable, fully catalogued musée des objets perdus, c'est formidable! And nothing less than those moments of our destinies and our histories whose signs have yet to be revealed. Having drafted her plan for an autumn amble, destination unknown as yet but entailing a right turn at every crossing, she puts the final touches to her opera, feeds the cat, pens a letter, and ties a bow in the unrepentant heart.
Thank you, Erin. Thank you so much. So, we have a few more minutes that we can go back to talking about you and your work and your book, Death Defying Acts, published by Word Farm.
Yes.
Word Farm was the publisher of both your books.
Yes.
Can you tell a few words about who are they and where are they located?
Well, they started out located in LaPorte, Indiana, which is outside of but commuting distance to Chicago. They're a small Midwestern press, but they've relocated to Seattle. I expect at some point the imprint will change back to LaPorte, Indiana, or thereabouts, because they're really Midwesterners at heart and they're just spending a few years working out in the Pacific Northwest. It's a small press. Andrew Kraft and Sally Sampson Kraft are the publishers, and Marcy Johnson, who is a Spalding graduate who went to grad school with me, she's the poetry editor. Mark Eddie Smith is the fiction editor. He's in New Hampshire right now. Marcy's in Michigan, so it's a bit of a virtual office too. So there are folks working all around the country.
In your first book that we also mentioned in your bio is The Gravity Soundtrack.
Yes.
And it was published 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
How are the two books different? And you mentioned that there are persona poems, and one of them is a novel, but do you feel differently about your books?
I do. My first book is really, it is The Gravity Soundtrack has lots of sort of different sections and moods and feelings in it. And some of the poems are persona poems. I write a lot about pop music in this book, in The Gravity Soundtrack. And so that's, which is something that I write about and think about a lot just in my daily life. But then also there are poems in here about classic children's books. And I would say in some ways it's a less focused book. I can admit that. It's a younger book also. I feel like that writing through all of these personas with my second book really kind of got the persona bug out of me. I don't know if I will write in persona for a while again. And it took me that long to really learn how to write in my own voice, actually, to be comfortable in my own voice.
What is your new work like?
Well, it's...
No more persona poems?
No more persona poems. No, that's my challenge. The collection that I'm working on right now, the challenge is that they will all be written from my point of view, from my perspective, and in my voice. And so what does that even sound? It started just as an exercise, as a challenge to myself. What does my poetic voice sound like after spending years inhabiting other characters' poetic voices?
And we know that you work as a teacher. What do you teach and where?
I teach a class called Pop Music and American Literature at Bellarmine University in Louisville. And I also teach in the online MFA program for National University. Right now I'm teaching a class on the pedagogy of creative writing. So it's the most meta experience ever to teach a class on how to teach a class on creative writing.
And, well, I ask all my creative writing teacher guests, what is the most important thing that they tell their students?
You know, the most important thing, especially if you're in a workshop situation, because workshop can be stressful, I think, for many students. The thing that I always want to impart upon them, because I had to learn this the hard way, was that it is less important to convince your peers of your genius than it is to be sure of your own purpose and intent in what you are writing. That doesn't mean that the feedback that you get is not important, but you have to view it through the lens of not, well, did they get it? But did I get it? Did I get what I was trying to say? And if you get, you know, if you're getting feedback that sounds like a completely wrong read of your work, you know, maybe they're not the best readers for your work. Always write for your best reader. But at the same time, maybe you're not quite representing the work that you're trying to represent yet on the page.
So basically, don't bring your ego in the workshop.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that, and that goes both ways too, for when you're on the other side of the critique.
Well, I've heard through my times in workshops that there are two kinds of people that should never go to workshops. One that don't take any advice.
Yeah.
And the other who take all advice.
Oh, that's brilliant. I'll use that too. It's the using the all advice too that can get really overwhelming, where you start, it can be easy to lose sight of the original intent of your, say, your poem when you hear smart things being said by smart people and you think, well, maybe I want to make this a sonnet, or maybe I should try writing this in the third person, you know, and then, but is that really what that poem needs to be? Maybe, but also maybe not.
Well, we have about 40 more seconds till the end of the show, so we should, I think, wrap it up. So thank you so much, Erin. I have, believe it or not, 3 more pages of questions that we didn't touch.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Maybe we can have you again at some point in the future. You're listening to Accents, a radio show for literature, art, and culture. I'm your host and producer, Katerina Stoikova-Klemmer. My guest today was poet Erin Keen. This is Katerina. It is 15 seconds to 3 p.m. and you're listening to WRFL 88.1 FM Lexington. This was Accents, a radio show for literature, art, and culture. Talk to you next week.